We're going to welcome to our program David McIlvaney, who is CEO of the McIlvaney Financial Companies, International Collectors Associates, ICA Europe, and McIlvaney Wealth Management. Perhaps you have seen him on CNBC, Fox News, Fox Business News, or Bloomberg. He has written a book, The Intentional Legacy. And I'll tell you what, it is a great read. It is available, just published earlier this month, so it's available in bookstores and online. And we are pleased to welcome to the program David McIlvaney. David, welcome to Front and Center.
Dan, great to be with you today.
This book covers so many areas, but I want to begin with you writing about the importance of a father in a family. How about talking about that?
You know, many years ago, I read a book by Paul Vitz, and he is a professor at New York University, and he highlights the way that people's perspective on life and the world is dramatically influenced by a father's presence or lack thereof. And we have a problem today, and a part of that is that even in cases where a father is engaged with his family, sometimes he's so engaged with his job and his profession that he forgets that actually there is a larger part to his investment in the success of his family, and that is time spent, quality as well as quantity of time with his children and with his wife. So a father's role is absolutely critical in defining the identities of children, and of course the lack of a father's presence is equally defining to a child's identity.
Now, your dad obviously was involved in your life, but as you write in the book, particularly at the outset, it wasn't the best of relationships as you grew into your teen years. Talk about that.
Well, the early tragedy in our family, Dan, was my dad, like many others, was taking opportunity and building a business. He's an entrepreneur. And for several years, he was gone 2, even 3 weeks out of the month. And that left us with some unhealthy dynamics at home, where my mom was basically raising us as a single mom. And, you know, again, just every family has dysfunction. Ours began to really emerge tangibly when I was in my teenage years. And I ran away. I lived at a youth ranch for over a year. And, you know, there was a lot of things that happened in the course of that that had me sort of estranged from our family. And on the other side of that, a lot of redemption has occurred, a lot of forgiveness and long conversations and things that I'm very pleased to say today. My father and I are great friends. We work together in business, in our family business, and there's been a lot that's been restored. But we went through some very difficult times, and, you know, it was really, I think, for me, at the edge of personal destruction and loss of what is today, I think, an important family legacy.
You had a turnaround moment at the Waffle House in your teen years when you and your dad went to have breakfast. Talk about that.
You know, when I came back from the youth ranch, Dan, I had to sign a 27-page contract that was sort of the rules of the road to be a part of the family and participate, the expectations that my family had of me, my parents had of me. And it wasn't but about 90 days after being back that I got in trouble again. And I knew that it was back to the ranch until I was 18. And so my dad invited me to the Waffle House, and we sat, and he asked me some questions, pointed questions about what I had done and why. And I came in with dukes up and ready for a verbal fisticuff. And his response to me, Dan, was one of grace. He said, "I'm very disappointed, but I forgive you." And it was my first encounter with that kind of life-transforming, what was for me a life-transforming moment. I knew things had to be different. In that moment, I owned the frailty and the folly of my ways, and I wanted to grow up. I wanted things to be different. And instead of getting into a verbal fight with my dad, that marked the turning point in my life because of the grace that he extended to me.
But as you write, the overall turning point might have occurred at the Waffle House, but you just didn't change your life overnight. It happened over a period of years, correct?
Well, I think it, when you look at legacy redemptions, this is something that you we've committed to as an ongoing deal. It, it, you know, there's success and failure, which are part of every one of our life, and it, how we deal with those failures is really a part of the ongoing story of redemption in any home. And so, no, that was the first significant battle that was fought and won in terms of regaining a legacy in our home. And, you know, certainly was hard fought for many years. Hours and hours spent talking, debating, arguing, praying, crying. Things that a father and son and a son and a mother, I'm glad that we invested in those events, because today we have a really healthy relationship, and I'm so proud of that.
Would you say that how you were able to turn your life around, how there was redemption in your family, is that the exception today rather than the rule? How would you measure that?
Well, I mean, I want to believe that it's not the exception to the rule, but I recognize that there are some key ingredients that going into there being redemption in a family. And so one of the things that I do talk about is sort of a redemptive ethic, where you, what you're committed to is continually putting things back together and finding common ground and being able to forgive each other. And a part of that is tied to what I call a visional ethic. A visional ethic is where you see someone really for the best that they have to offer and were intended to become, and you treat them accordingly. So there I was, 14 years old, an absolute punk in every way. And there were a number of people that treated me with great dignity and saw in me the fledgling young man that I could become, not necessarily the path that I was on, because I was on a pretty rough path, but they treated me with the kind of dignity and respect, and they saw in me what I could not see in myself at that time. And that sense of having a vision for me and then treating me accordingly, I really think that that opened the door for me to mature and grow. And when you embrace a visional ethic within the home, it allows you to see past the current crisis, the current arguments, the current problems and dysfunction, to something that again, ties the heart and the home to something very critical, which I think is hope.
Religion is really the foundation of your life, at least by reading this book. Was it always that way?
No, and I'm not sure that it has to be for everyone. I think there's some core principles that apply regardless of sort of how you affiliate. But I do think that love and forgiveness are really critical to a successful family legacy. Because one of the things that I wanted to point out in this book is that for most wealth professionals, I mean, we're in the wealth management business. We've been in the precious metals brokerage business for close to 50 years. We've helped people secure their financial legacies, and over and over and over again, we see wealth transferred from one generation to the next, only to be squandered very quickly because there were issues which were never addressed. We see the infighting of brothers and sisters when there's a reading of the will, and it's a free-for-all for who gets what and why they're justified in getting it all. And I think what needs to happen as people consider or reconsider legacy is to say, actually, there are intangible resources which have to be managed right alongside the tangible resources. And these intangibles deal with family identity. They deal with character. They deal with issues of family cohesion and love and loyalty. What are the things that make your family uniquely your family? What makes you interested in being a part of your family from one day to the next, from one generation to the next? These, I think, are the issues which really have to be looked at. So in the process of doing so, you're doing an accounting function. What are the blessings that we've received from earlier generations, and what is the baggage that we've received from earlier generations, and how do we keep one and dispose of the other so that our relationships ongoing are not damaged by things that you know represent sort of dysfunction from one generation to the next. I think it's a very exciting project, actually, to reconsider legacy and say we can do better but it's going to take some hard work, and it's going to take some intellectual growth, and it's going to take some emotional maturity. And yes, there is a spiritual element in it for most people, I think for many people.
In many ways, the basis of the book, and obviously it's in the title, and we're talking with David McIlvaney, CEO, McIlvaney Financial Companies, the title of the book, The Intentional Legacy. Legacy defines in this book more than just financial legacy, correct?
Well, that's right. A legacy is your life message. This is the sum of your values and your vision. It's what you want to leave to others, both in the form of tangible wealth. Don't get me wrong, that's a part of it, but it's also the intangible assets which speak to your family culture, your faith, your identity, the virtues. These are things that need to be cultivated. And so the idea of being intentional about this, we can, at the end of our lives, find ourselves with a result. In fact, I would say that legacy is an inescapable concept. We will all leave a legacy. The question is, how carefully have you been in crafting that legacy? Because there's daily choices that we make which will go into the family dynamics which create all of the intangibles that we leave. And so how intentional are you in that process? It's a concept that I refer to as reverse engineering, where you take your highest ideals and goals and work back from what you envision out on the horizon in order to put in practical terms actions and choices that you might make today to get you there.
There are so many great messages in this book. Among them, and it's one of my favorites, is as a family, you sit around the dinner table and eat. You're not eating while watching television. You're not eating in another room. You're eating as a family together, and you're conversing together rather than getting on one of our electronic devices. How about elaborating on that?
What happens at the dinner table? Again, for many people, this can be watching television and again, checking, as you say, your personal mobile device. For us, it's a time to relax, to enjoy each other, to unpack what's happened in the day. And for family with young kids, one of the things that we're doing is giving our kids a vocabulary that relates to what goes on internal to them, intellectually and emotionally. How did they encounter the day? What were their happies today? What were their sads? What were the things that were inspiring to them? What were the things that were discouraging to them? And for them to be given a voice and to be valued every day, I want to know their story. My wife wants to know their story. And we sit and we talk, and sometimes we talk about economics and politics and world events. You know, this last night, we were talking about the 30 Years' War, and I was learning from my 10-year-old son things that I never learned growing up. So it can range all over the place in terms of the topics that we cover. But you know what's happening implicit to what we're doing? We're creating ties. We're creating relationship. We're creating memories. And as such, food is a centerpiece. Food is not something that is just fuel in our home. It is an opportunity to share something, to create something, to celebrate around something, and to begin to create a context for them when they're older to look back and say, with deep sentiment, I loved how we did this. When we grew up, these were the sights and sounds and smells, and this is how we celebrated, and this was my first glass of wine, and these are the things that my family would toast to, and these were the topics. I want my kids to be inspired when they think about family life, and I want them to have been able to express themselves and grow and flourish in all of these critical areas, intellectually, emotionally, spiritually. So as they grow up personally, they develop those maturity levels. How? I think it takes time and practice and some guidance. And the dinner table ends up being, for us, kind of a workshop for human growth, a place where they can learn and develop with some guidance from us.
Your children are homeschooled, is that correct?
And that is correct. And a part of that is a choice to be able to engage with them as I travel for business. I travel probably 90 days out of the year. And it would be a disaster for us, frankly, and I know well what that disaster looks like, and I experienced firsthand the dysfunction created by a man who wanted to be successful in business, and I don't fault my father for that. I now understand it better than ever, what is required of a man to take care of his family, but I would say I want to do that in every possible life category, not just as the proverbial breadwinner, but as someone who's offering guidance in other areas too. So, you know, it's interesting. We learn from our past, not so that we can sort of, you know, point blame at past generations, but so that we can appreciate them. We can appreciate the good and the bad. And I look at our opportunity as parents today, and I'm absolutely thrilled that we get to put in front of them both our successes and failures, have them learn from us, and do better. Well, I want the next generation to do better than me in every respect, to grow beyond what I've been able to do and grow, and the lessons that we've learned thus far. That's what I aspire for my kids.
But there are challenges. So what are some of the challenges of homeschooling your children?
Yeah, the challenges, I think a lot of that relates to just being extended, almost overextended as a family. I mean, the today's modern life, you know, you've got music lessons and you've got dance and you've got, my kids are involved in musical theater and jujitsu, and you've got five different things that you're engaged with outside of the home. And quite frankly, my wife never gets a break, because as engaged as she is with the kids and their activities outside the home, she's also got the weight of teaching them in every class and field of study. So that's a major challenge for us, but it's one that we embrace because we have a philosophy of education that's pretty robust. And to your earlier question, why we homeschool, a part of it is I do travel a lot, and this enables us to take our kids all over the world. Our kids have been around the world multiple times. We conduct business in Europe and in Asia and in South America. And, you know, just recently got back from a trip from South Africa, and my oldest went as I spoke at a conference on economics. And he got to see me in my element. And, of course, we spent a few days at a game park and looked at wild animals, which he was not opposed to at all. But this is our life, and homeschooling helps us facilitate life on our terms rather than being forced into the regular school schedule. We can adjust and adapt and customize, and that's why we do it.
Talking with David McElvaney, author of the book The Intentional Legacy. In the book, you quote Harry Truman. You write a great chapter about reading, that we don't read enough books anymore, that we might be online, we might be reading on the internet, Facebook, this, that, and the other thing, but reading books. And it's a great quote: not all readers are leaders, but all leaders are readers. Talk about that.
Well, I hope that quote is not upended by the current president-elect, because I think this might be the first time in history where we have someone who's entering into a leadership position, and he's admittedly said, I'm just not much of a reader. So maybe that is now a contentious statement. But if you look at history, you do see men who read and women who read very broadly, who are in positions of leadership. They want to understand the complexity of the world. They don't necessarily like negative surprise, and it's helpful to have read very broadly. When I think of legacy, I think of a library as one of those things which represents the heart and soul of a family. And, you know, you open up any book in our house, and in the margins, there are all kinds of notes, a dialogue with the author, sometimes an argument, sometimes a debate, sometimes just simple commentary that, yeah, I agree with that completely. And what is left in the margins, books that I've received from my father and grandfather, books that I'll leave to my kids, there is an insight into my mind and heart. And you see this as an opportunity to learn from earlier generations, even when those generations aren't there. So I know my grandfather's thoughts on certain topics because I see in the margins his interaction with an author. And I've done the same thing. Our library, as I've told my kids, is more important than gold and silver, because there are ideas within the books on our shelves which may change their life, may change this country, may in fact change the world. And so we are constantly, constantly engaged in a treasure hunt for the transcendent. These are ideas which will change and have the power to change an individual or the world. And so we don't look at books as sort of a mere academic pursuit. this is where we go adventuring. This is where we go adventuring because we know the power of ideas.
And you write about a mentor in your life, David. You write about a mentor in your life who'd read from 5 in the morning until 8 in the morning every day. Newspapers, the Bible, books, every day he did that.
Well, that's right. I mean, important to him was the obituaries in the New York Times and what was playing on Broadway and reading from Psalms and Proverbs and reading from 5 different news sources, whether it was The Economist or Kiplinger or The Wall Street Journal, to have a broad perspective about current events. This was a man engaged in public life, and this was a man who thought deeply about so many different topics. And I learned from that not only the depth of his reading, but also the breadth of his reading. And he did it in such a way that, quite frankly, it didn't disturb from family life. It didn't take away from family life. It added to family life. He started at 5 and went to 8 and sat and had breakfast with his family. And I learned a tremendous amount about sort of how he organized continuing to grow intellectually. It was fascinating, fascinating guy.
We have about a minute left, David. Talk a bit about McIlvaney Financial Companies.
McIlvaney Financial Companies, we're a wealth management group. We also broker precious metals. Just launching a short fund, actually, the end of this year with one of the most talented asset managers in the world in that small space. And we're engaged in the markets as we are engaged in our own home as thoughtfully as we can, trying to seek out value. And we've been doing that for close to 50 years. I'm excited to say this is a second generation project, and what I'm trying to put in motion still with our businesses is something that can last 2 or 3 or 4 more generations, because there is this challenge, and that's why I wrote this book, The Shirt Sleeves to Shirt Sleeves in 3 Generations. What one generation creates can be squandered by the 3rd or 4th generation. And I want to make sure that the values not only of our firm but in our family allow us to take the resources that we have, tangible and intangible, and move it from the current generation to the next and the next and the next. And that's the purpose of the intentional legacy, is to explore how you can do that, what you want for your family, why you want it, and how you get there.
The name of the book, The Intentional Legacy, by David McIlvaney. David, thank you very much for being a guest on Front and Center.
And folks can find us at davidmcilvaney.com.
Terrific. You take care.
Thank you, Dan.